It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. Now in the center of our service and the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter moments. We use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. The prayer for this morning from the book that I used as the primary book for the information about the goddesses for 2 weeks ago and today. It was a book by a Jungian psychiatrist, a woman named Jean Shinoda Bolan. And she was very good. If you're new to the church or visiting the church, it might seem strange to come to a church in the 21st century talking about ancient Greek gods and goddesses. So maybe a very quick religion 101 lesson is in order. The gods and goddesses that we create are created to focus things that feel absolutely essential and permanent and eternal parts of the human condition. And I think no one did this more self-consciously than the Greeks. Their gods were projections of the dynamics that they find in people in all times and places, natural dynamics, and so on. So Jean Shinoda Bolan, the author, created a prayer to the goddesses, to the kinds of powers and dynamics that they represented. And I want to take the prayer to four of the goddesses, the four we'll be talking about this morning for us. We'll do them in two different ways. Athena, help me to think clearly in this situation. Artemis, keep me focused on the distant goal. Aphrodite, help me to love and enjoy my body. Hestia, honor me with your presence. Bring me peace and serenity. Let's put them together. O Spirit of life, love, and creation, help us to think clearly. Keep us focused on our distant goals. Help us to love and enjoy our body. And honor us with your presence. Bring us peace and serenity. Amen. When I was thinking about this sermon late in the week, it suddenly occurred to me that part of what this is really about is the difference between politics and religion. It may not seem that way, but it's what it's really about, even though I'm talking about goddesses. So I'll talk about that a little bit at the end. 2 weeks ago, I talked about the first three goddesses. The Greeks had, initially, they had six women and six men in their pantheon of goddesses. And that was just sort of a way of recognizing both sort of archetypal masculine and feminine styles and dynamics that always seem to be part of the human situation, the human condition. They called them gods and goddesses because we can't wish them away. They're there whether we like it or not, and we have to deal with it whether we like it or not. And we do have these different demands on us that don't agree. As many have observed through the years, the gods and goddesses not only disagree, they bicker. The Greeks later added a seventh goddess to this, and that's the goddess of the maiden, or daughter. So 2 weeks ago, we talked about what they called the dependent goddesses. Many people have seen that the goddesses kind of fall into two categories. The dependent goddesses of wife, mother, and daughter, or maiden, whose identities are in orbits around men. And the independent goddesses, or virgin goddesses, who, whether or not they had anything to do with men, it had virtually nothing to do with their identity. They're goddesses who spoke under their own authority and were quite powerful. Now, the other caution on this, and it came from the comment of one or two women who came through the line after the first service, is to say, all right, I know some of you are sitting there thinking, this is just what we need, a man telling us about women. That no matter what I do, it's going to be hard to establish much real authority on this. So I could be wrong on this. That's why I'm quoting a woman author. But I know that if you're going to be dabbling in the business of the goddesses, you need some humility. It's very dangerous territory. The four independent goddesses that I want to talk about today were Artemis, the hunter, and Athena, the warrior, and Hestia, the mystic, the contemplative, the invisible spirit, the hardest to picture in some ways, and then the wild card, Aphrodite. I want to talk about these, but I'm not talking about goddesses. I'm talking about dynamics that are still very much alive and with us. Artemis was the hunter who spurned both men and society. I've always thought, I don't like her much. I don't think I would have wanted to be around her, because every Artemis story involving a man, it always turns out very badly for the man. Two of the most famous stories about her show this. One involved a lover she had briefly named Orion, whom she accidentally killed. They were just competing, and her competitive nature took over, and it just got carried away. The other story is the more famous one, probably the most famous Artemis story that I know of. And that's the story with the young hunter Actaeon, a hunter who happened, with his dogs out hunting deer, who happened to stumble on the grotto where Artemis and her attendants were bathing. And he saw her naked. In other words, he saw her vulnerability, and that's what Artemis can't acknowledge. And she was so angry for it that she turned him into a stag and his own dogs killed him. Men don't fare well in these stories with Artemis. This was the goddess whose mottos could have been, don't tread on me and don't fence me in, or men beware. She was also the only goddess who repeatedly came to the aid of her mother. All of her close friends are women. During the heyday of the women's movement in the 70s, we had an Artemis figure, and her incarnation here was certainly Gloria Steinem. I remember my favorite of Gloria Steinem's sound bites, and she was good at sound bites. And she didn't marry for decades and was asked once, even though she had men in her life, she was asked once why she didn't marry, and her reply was pure Artemis. She said, I don't breed in captivity. These are tough people. Another of the independent goddesses, we'll come back to Artemis later because she played a role in our culture that we need to be more aware of. Another of the independent goddesses was Athena, whom the Romans called Minerva, and who in many respects was the polar opposite of Artemis. She wore armor. She was a warrior. She protected her chosen heroes vigorously, and all of her heroes were men. She was a daddy's girl. The myth had it that she was born from the head of Zeus, and even though the Greek mythology records the name of her mythical mother, she never acknowledged her mother in her life. Anytime women crossed her path, it went badly for the women, at least in all the stories that I know of her. When Athena is pictured with another, that other is invariably a male. Achilles, for instance, or Odysseus, the heroes of the Iliad and the Odyssey. These are Athenas. This is a woman who fought for male values and male privilege. Unlike Artemis, she fought with men and against women. Two of her, I'm not sure I would have liked her either. These are both terrifying goddesses, I think. Two of her stories show this, and they're so different from the Artemis stories. The first was the story of Agamemnon, and this is, it was a minor part of the story, but it's such a major part of her that it's worth bringing in. Agamemnon was the king who was a king and a father and a husband and a general. So he's really serving and owes allegiance to four different gods or goddesses. In other words, there are four different conflicting demands on him that he has to find a way to balance, is the way we'd put it today. The Greeks made up stories, wonderful stories, and we just sort of tell it. A great battle was looming, and the winds died down, so the ships wouldn't sail. And if the ships don't sail, he loses the battle. Now, in the Greek mythology, this meant some god is angry that the winds are down. You have to find out who's angry and what they want, and you have to do it so the ships can sail. If the ships don't sail, you lose the war, your people are killed, your women and children and their daughters are taken, and all kinds of awful things happen. So they consulted the oracle, and they found out that probably the last person you'd want angry is the one who's angry if you're a warrior, and that's Athena. Athena is angry. And they asked what has to be done to satisfy him, and the demand is one I think only Athena would ever have made, and that's that he has to kill his daughter. Athena is very different from Artemis. In one version of the story, Artemis appeared to argue against Athena and to defend the girl. There is no instance in Greek mythology that I know of where Artemis ever won over Athena. He killed the girl. And the rest of the story you know if you know the story of Agamemnon. The second story is more famous and a lot more fun, and it will give you the answer to a trivial pursuit question that you'll probably never be asked. It may not even exist as a trivial pursuit question, but it's certainly an answer to some trivia. And it's the story, Athena, besides being the goddess of warriors, was also the goddess of weaving. And it's a story about a human weaver, a woman named Arachne. The name already rings a bell. You already know how the story is going to end. But this is how it happened. Arachne was a great weaver, and she even boasted once, when people told her how good she was, she even boasted that not even Athena could touch her. Now, I used to read Greek myths to my stepdaughters, and I had a 9-year-old who just loved these stories. And we'd been through 5 or 6 books of them, and she knew them all cold, and just each new book was kind of a new variation on stories that she knew. And so somewhere in this 4th or 5th time through all these stories, we got a new book, and we came to this story again. And we came, and she would just nod, because she knew all the stories by then. They were friends, and we got to this part where Arachne said that she was even better than Athena. And Allison poked me, and she said, "She's dead meat." Athena challenged Arachne to a weaving duel to be judged by some people, and they both wove absolutely perfect tapestries. There was not even a tiny flaw in either one. It would have been a draw. But that isn't what did Arachne in. Athena, as daddy's girl, wove pictures of her father Zeus's great exploits. Arachne wove pictures of Zeus's infidelities and sexual liaisons. That's what made Athena mad, not the fact that she was as good a weaver. Athena tore up the weaving and, as you've guessed, turned Arachne, the weaver, into a spider. And that's why we call spiders arachnids. It comes from this story. But it's also a reminder that if you're a man, you really don't want to cross paths with Artemis, and if you're a woman, you really don't want to cross paths with Athena. Powerful deities. The third independent goddess is a very interesting one, the only one in all the Greek pantheon who was never pictured. No pictures, no statues, no nothings of Hestia. She's the invisible one. Hestia was really pure spirit. She was like a spirit of contentment, derived from going within, a contemplative spirit, either in involvement with homemaking, and homemaking was a big part of Hestia's activity, or just spiritual meditation. I've always thought it was a delicious irony that Hestia is the patron goddess of all Catholic convents. Hestia's spirit is what makes a house a home, or what makes a church service into a worship service. You feel it when it's there, and you feel it when it's not. You know when it's missing. You can't see it. It hasn't got a face, but it's absolutely unmistakable and wonderfully powerful and creative. This is Hestia. The final goddess is the most complex, sometimes the most fun, and that's the wild card goddess Aphrodite, whom the Romans called Venus, the goddess of love and beauty. The Greeks, in some bizarre sense of perverted humor, married Aphrodite to the lame craftsman Hephaestus, who worked underground. She spent no time with him. She was never faithful to him and bore him no children. She had numerous affairs with both gods and men and bore several children to them. Her favorite consort was the god of war, Ares, or Mars. Now think about this. This is the sort of thing Greeks did with their myths and their gods. This is a terrifying idea. Marrying the passions of love and war together. Think of the offspring that would come from that kind of a mating. If you're really going to be optimistic about it, you could think, and sometimes it happens, it could produce harmony. It's possible that love and war could finally produce harmony. That's what you always hope in a war. That's what we're always told in a war. More often, they're going to produce fear and terror. And one of the great clues to the fact that the Greeks knew exactly what they were doing when they created their gods and their myths is that the name of the three children of love and war were fear, terror, and harmony. So mythology isn't a fiction about some other world. It's insights into the deeper levels of our own, tools to help us search for harmony rather than fear or terror. Aphrodite was, in paradoxical ways, really the most like Hestia, the introverted Hestia, in that both of them found their completion by following their passion. Hestia withdrew from men while Aphrodite interacted with them, but Aphrodite interacted with men the way a wine connoisseur interacts with wine. You just enjoy a few sips and move on to the next glass. The t-shirt slogan from the 70s, "So many men, so little time," was Aphrodite's. And while both followed powerful feelings, the Greeks were aware that while the feelings were powerful, they were not necessarily wise. Think about it. A Hestia-type woman can become absorbed in the rituals of housework within an unfulfilling or even an abusive marriage. And while meditation or spiritual exercises can help center or deepen a life, they can also become opiates that numb you to a life that desperately needs to be changed. They're powerful, not necessarily wise. And Aphrodite's stories show why the Greeks believed that love was blind. The passion is irresistible, but not necessarily wise. Among the Aphrodite stories are two, where she made a girl fall in love with her father and a mother fall in love with her stepson. Both stories had horrible, tragic endings. Two modern incarnations of the Aphrodite spirit, you may have your own ideas, could be Madonna or J-Lo. A generation ago, we thought of Marilyn Monroe this way, though Ava Gardner was probably a better
a better candidate. In Marilyn Monroe, I think you had something much more complex. You kind of had Aphrodite combined with a deadly vulnerability, and the combination was more than she could hold together. When you think of these styles of the Greek goddesses, and if you're going to say, all right, if they're goddesses, it means they're always with us. These styles are always here. And then you think of our culture over the last 50 years, it offers some different lenses to look at where we've been and what's happened. 2 weeks ago, I talked about after World War II, it was the dependent goddesses, the wife, mother, daughter, who really dominated American society and culture. This is the era of Father Knows Best and Ozzie and Harriet and all these things. By 1950, the birth rate in the United States equaled India's for the only time. That's the rise of dependent goddesses. 20 years later, in the 1970s, very different goddesses were ruling, to put it in goddess terms. This was the decade of the women's movement, vintage years for both Artemis and Athena, when feminists and career women took center stage. More women than ever were now in school pursuing doctoral, business, medicine, and law degrees. The 70s were also, I think, when the University of Texas Law School was finally open to women. That really through the efforts of Oscar Mosey, whose wife Anne was in the early service here today. Divorce rates soared, birth rates dropped, and women whose identities were involved with being a wife and mother often found themselves being ridiculed. This certainly happened in a lot of Unitarian churches. Simone de Beauvoir, in her classic book, The Second Sex, wrote that even if women want to have children, they should be dissuaded from doing so because it puts them in those roles. So the biases changed and the discriminations changed in the 70s. Now Artemis styles burst forth powerfully against men's rules and often against men. They burned their bras. They made posters that said, woman needs man like a fish needs a bicycle. I love that poster. I remember seeing that in the 70s in Ann Arbor, wondering who made this up? I mean, was this a party where they were really, really stoned? They said, I got an idea. We don't get to hear that part of the history, but this was the women's movement that began working to add an equal rights amendment to the Constitution. We usually think of this as an Artemis movement. Those of us who lived through it, I think, would mostly think of it as an Artemis movement, certainly the way it felt. But when the independent goddesses come, they all come as a group. And the reason we need to know this is because all of this is replaying now. And it might be helpful to be more aware now than we were 30 years ago. And what that means is anytime Artemis appears, somewhere there will be Athena. And never in Greek mythology has Artemis defeated Athena. So that's worth knowing. And it's worth asking who the Athena figures are. In the 70s, it was as good an incarnation of Athena as you're likely to find in a culture. She was a Phi Beta Kappa woman with a master's degree from Radcliffe named Phyllis Schlafly. Yeah, but see, you're not making appreciative noises. Before you want a warrior, before her leadership of the opposition, ratification of the ERA seemed inevitable. In the first 12 months of its life, the year before, Phyllis Schlafly formed her organization called Stop ERA in October 1972, 32 years ago. The ERA had rolled up ratifications from 30 states. Once Schlafly led her troops into battle, and that's the right way to put it, I think, the momentum stopped. In the next eight years, only five more states added ratifications and five other states rescinded their ratifications. That's a warrior goddess who can stop all movement. It's incredible. Now, if you look at current events in terms of mythic Greek goddesses, it can be helpful remembering that the reason that Athena had her power, this is my sense of it, is that Artemis could appeal to some women, not all, a few men, not many. Athena can appeal to many women and a lot of men, which is probably why in Greek mythology she has superior forces, which means that if it's coming up again, those who want rights for women and for many people, I think, will need to look for some way to harmonize rather than to pit them against each other. Greek mythology would warn us that if we pit them against each other, we already know who's going to win. The lesson I want to draw, though I want to come back to that, is different. And one lesson from looking at all these goddesses, and you can do the same with the gods for male types, looking at all these goddesses is how inadequate any one or any three are to give women the options that they need to grow and to be. If you only have the goddesses of wife, mother, and daughter without some fighter, without some Athena or some Artemis, women can become victims or slaves. It isn't enough. Without some softness, the Artemis styles can become very harsh and very hateful. That isn't enough. But the main point I want to make is that when you put it this way with the goddesses, Artemis and Athena warring against each other, this is no longer religion. This is politics. And if you've wondered all your life about the difference between politics and religion, here it is. Don't take notes, you'll hear it again. Politics is always a war between partial visions. It's always one partial vision fighting for power against and over another partial vision. Each side omits, can't see, and can't do justice to or integrate what the other side sees so clearly. Politics is always a war between partial visions, where no vision can be wholly adequate. Religion, by definition, must always be the search for a holistic vision, an integrative vision, rather than the one that pits parts against the other. As all this stuff gets ready to replay in our culture now, I guess if I were a politician, I'd be fighting for power, for my partial vision against the other, trying to find ways to include enough parts of the other to increase the warriors in my army. As a preacher, I think that we need to be looking for visions that are bigger than political visions and more inclusive and more whole. We don't need to champion this or that god or goddess, though that's what the whole society is teaching us to do. We need to be championing instead this goal of a harmony between them, and the harmony is something the gods and goddesses couldn't do. And the Greeks knew that the harmony between these competing urges is something only we can do, and we must do, or we'll forever be stuck in political battles of partial visions, each seeking power over the other. This harmony that we're seeking was not done in the lifetime of those who wrote the Greek myths. It won't be done in our lifetime. It won't be done in the lifetime of those who follow. That's why it's a religious quest, because it's always with us. The task for each person in each new generation always has to be to accomplish this harmony again. The gods can't do it for us. It's our task. It's our task alone, and it's our task together. In the coming months and years, in our lives and in our society and in our world, let it be a task that calls us to it.